Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world. Produced on WSCALP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, November 19th, 2011. Here's what we have coming up for you. After news you need to know, we hear a Between the Lines interview discussing ongoing rights violations of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli prisons. Then, a WBAI news report brings us audio from a recent panel on U.S. job growth. Another Between the Lines interview then brings us an update on Occupy Wall Street protests. Hidden Histories delves into some Thanksgiving Day realities, and Outside the Box with Larry Danziger suggests an alternative saying of grace for Thanksgiving. We'll also have music and more, so stay with us. First, for some news.
This is Steve Diamond with News You Need to Know, this week focusing on more U.S. and Israeli terrorism on Iran. As I've reported and documented at nhmakingwaves.org already, this has been going on for a long time, but now U.S. and Israeli politicians are openly discussing how great this aggression is. But first, this from antiwar.com on November 8th. The IAEA, quote, is unable to provide credible assurance about the absence of undeclared nuclear material and activities in Iran. Note that it's generally impossible to prove a country is not seeking a nuclear weapon. The same could have been said about nearly any country. The selective application of anti-proliferation scrutiny proves its biased political motivation. The report also stated that, quote, the agency continues to verify the non-diversion of Iran's declared nuclear material, but that the IAEA cannot completely rule out a military dimension to Iran's nuclear program. The report provides circumstantial evidence provided by Western intelligence sources. No direct evidence is provided of an active weaponization program. The report's concerns mostly arise from the absence of evidence disproving weaponization. The U.S. has waged two aggressive, unnecessary wars directly against Iran's east and west borders, constantly floods the Persian Gulf with fleets of Navy warships, props up client states surrounding Iran with weapons systems and money, and heaps restrictive sanctions on Iran. In addition, the Bush administration had received from Congress funding for a program of support for rebel ethnic groups in Iran to work to undermine the government. For years now, a concerted U.S. campaign of cyber terrorism, commercial sabotage, targeted assassinations, and proxy wars has been underway in Iran. In other words, the U.S. government is massively funding terrorist activities against Iran, and they barely even bother to pretend that it's covert between their threats of preemptively starting all-out war against Iran. Keep that in mind when wondering which side is the crazed aggressor in this. And from antiwar.com on November 11th. In comments broadcast today by Hezbollah on TV, Hassan Nasrallah cautioned the U.S. and Israel against attacking Iran, saying such a move would start a war across the entire region. He also warned a Western invasion of Syria would have a similar outcome. He said, quote, I'm not threatening, but anyone with sense can see that. And from antiwar.com on November 10th. Speaking at a news conference today, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta declared that a U.S. military attack on Iran might have unintended consequences. And the story from Haaretz that antiwar.com cited on November 11th. Iran insists it is pursuing nuclear energy for peaceful purposes and has warned it would lash back if attacked. Speculation about an attack on Iran was fueled last week when Israel, widely assumed to have the Middle East's only nuclear arsenal, test-launched a long-range missile, and by comments by Prime Minister Netanyahu that Tehran's nuclear program posed a, quote, direct and heavy threat. In other words, while Iran may eventually have the knowledge needed to create nukes, Israel has them now and is testing delivery systems while threatening to attack first. And now this story on the partner of peace the Palestinians are expected to embrace. From antiwar.com on November 1st. With government spokesmen terming yesterday's UNESCO vote a national tragedy, the Israeli government announced today that it will dramatically accelerate the construction of settlements in the occupied territories. 1,650 more housing units will be built in occupied East Jerusalem, and hundreds more in the rest of the West Bank. And from antiwar.com on November 17th. Israel's defense minister has had to back down from statements he made on U.S. television on Tuesday that made him seem to empathize with Iran's alleged quest for nuclear weapons. When asked if he would, quote, want a nuclear weapon, were he a member of Iran's government, Barak said, quote, probably. I don't delude myself that they are doing it just because of Israel. They look around, they see the Indians are nuclear, the Chinese are nuclear, Pakistan is nuclear, not to mention the Russians. When asked by Charlie Rose whether Israel's possession of nuclear weapons also might compel Iran towards seeking nuclear weapons capability, Barak said, quote, yeah, Israel, allegedly. It seemed an accidental slip from typical U.S.-Israeli propaganda that the Iranian government wants a nuclear weapon because they are irrational religious fanatics who want to destroy Israel. But Hans Blix, former head of the IAEA, said recently that Iran is operating out of a perception of threat. Blix explains that a change in U.S.-Israeli behavior is the best way to ensure that Iran is not tempted to attain a nuclear deterrent. InformantiWar.com on November 17th. Senator Mark Kirk proposed additional economic sanctions on Iran aimed at stifling the Iranian economy. One of the bill's top supporters, Representative Brad Sherman, said, quote, critics of the sanctions argued that these measures will hurt the Iranian people. Quite frankly, we need to do just that, close quote. Many of the proponents proudly referenced the sanctions imposed against Saddam Hussein's Iraq in the 1990s. Not only did those sanctions have no favorable effect on Iraq's policies, but they are also known to have directly contributed to the deaths of up to 1 million Iraqis, including hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children. And from Antiwar.com on November 12th. Iran must respond to the UN report suggesting it may have a clandestine nuclear weapons program, Secretary of State Clinton said. The IAEA released a report this week, cobbling together uncorroborated intelligence from mainly U.S. and Israeli sources in an attempt to imply Iran may have a secret nuclear weapons program. Clinton must have missed when Iran actually did respond to the report. The Iranian government sent its envoy to the IAEA around the world to discuss the report and made public statements claiming the report was false and politically motivated. And from Antiwar.com on November 17th. Any preemptive Israeli attack on Iran would target civilian infrastructure as well as its nuclear facilities, according to a report in the Daily Beast. Anonymous U.S. intelligence officials said that the Israeli attack, quote, would likely include electronic warfare against Iran's electric grid, internet, cell phone network, and emergency frequencies for firemen and police. Such an attack might constitute a deliberate violation of international law, which prohibits targeting civilian infrastructure for attack. InformantiWar.com on November 14th. Saturday's deadly blast at an Iranian military base was termed an accident by Iranian officials. But a growing number of reports are coming out, particularly in the Israeli press, which are calling the blast a collaborative effort between Israeli intelligence and the MEK, an Iranian terrorist group which has received considerable support in recent months from Western officials hoping to use them in a war against Iran. If this was indeed a covert Israeli attack, it might explain why the Israeli Defense Minister, Ehud Barak, thought the explosion was great news, saying, quote, it would be desirable if they multiply. Note that some conservatives have been pressing to have the MEK removed from the State Department's list of terrorist organizations. No matter what an organization does, they're not considered terrorists if they attack the right people. And from Antiwar.com on November 12th. Republican presidential candidates were bombastic in Saturday night's debate on the issue of Iran. When asked whether he would choose to strike Iran militarily, Romney said, quote, absolutely, so long as aggressive sanctions and covert war failed to end their nuclear enrichment, which you should note they have a right to do as members of the NPT. Newt Gingrich advocated for increased covert terrorism against Iran. He suggested employing, quote, maximum covert operations, including taking out their scientists. He also advocated, quote, actively funding every dissident group in Iran, supporting with money and weapons domestic factions in adversarial countries. Essentially supporting terrorism aimed at regime change is a long-time activity of the U.S. government, but only recently made explicit. Rick Santorum agreed with Gingrich. Quote, you know there have been scientists turning up dead in Russia and Iran. There have been computer viruses. There have been problems at their facility. I hope that the U.S. has been involved with that, Santorum said. He then explicitly advocated for a preemptive unilateral strike against Iran. But Ron Paul insisted, it isn't worthwhile to go to war with Iran. Quote, I'm afraid what's going on right now is similar to the war propaganda that went on against Iraq, and they didn't have weapons of mass destruction. And from the BBC on November 9th, Russia has ruled out supporting fresh sanctions against Iran. Russia's deputy foreign minister said that extra sanctions could be interpreted as a means of regime change. And Iran's president said, quote, why do you damage the UN agency's dignity because of America's invalid claims? "We will not build two bombs in the face of your 20,000. Close quote. And from Antiwar.com and The Guardian of Britain on October 30th. One would think the enormous budget struggles that are besetting virtually every major military on the planet would have extraneous spending curbed. Not so, says a new report, which predicts hundreds of billions of dollars in new spending on the modernization and upgrading of nuclear weapon systems across the various nuclear weapons-possessing nations. And from Antiwar.com, also covered by the British Guardian and the BBC, and eventually by CNN, the Boston Globe, and even Fox News, on November 7th. In one of the most bizarre stories in recent memory, French President Sarkozy and Barack Obama were caught making catty comments about Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu at the G20 conference. "I cannot stand him. He is a liar," declared Sarkozy, speaking to Obama in one of the private rooms, but having left his microphone running for all the media to hear. "You're fed up with him," remarked Obama. "I have to deal with him every day." The conversation continued for nearly 3 minutes before the microphones were shut off, but incredibly went mostly uncovered by major media outlets in the wake of the conference. One journalist present said there was a discussion held after the supposed gaffe, and everyone, quote, agreed not to publish the comments due to the sensitivity of the issue. The bumbling attempt at covering it up worked for a few days, with no major outlet covering it. They only came to light when a foreign media watchdog covered it, along with the efforts to intimidate the press into not covering it. Incredibly, those present were quick to confirm that they were in fact cowed into not covering the story. And finally, from Antiwar.com on November 11th, Dennis Ross, President Obama's top Middle East aide, who has attracted criticism for his allegedly strong pro-Israel sympathies, will leave his post at the end of this month, the White House announced. He will rejoin the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, an Israel-centered think tank that was spun off from the powerful lobbying group AIPAC. Ross has focused in particular on U.S. policy toward Iran, about which he has long held hawkish views, and on Arab-Israeli relations, especially the U.S.-led Israel-Palestinian so-called peace process, which appears to have reached a dead end under his supervision. Despite the generally hawkish views of WINEP's fellows and their frequent criticism of Obama's approach to the Middle East, Ross said in a statement that his departure from the White House was due to family reasons. In the run-up to the 2008 elections, Ross participated in two task forces on Iran policy, which called for military strikes against Iran if it did not agree to abandon its uranium enrichment program. So it looks like Obama is discreetly resisting starting yet another disastrous war.
Thanks to Steve Diamond for that news we need to know. You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Next, we have an interview brought to us by Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. It will focus on violations of Palestinian prisoners' rights who are being held in Israeli prisons.
In mid-October, Israel and Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Party that controls Gaza, agreed to a prisoner swap. 1,027 Palestinian political prisoners were traded for the release of Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, who has been held by Hamas since June 2006. Many Israelis were horrified by the release of Palestinians, some of whom had been convicted for violent crimes against Israelis, and some Palestinians were angry that many of the prisoners released were sent into exile. On a just-concluded trip to Israel and Palestine, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended a talk by Clea Towan, the international advocacy officer, with Adamir, a Palestinian prisoner support and human rights association. She discusses the large number of Palestinians who've been arrested under the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, all but 0.3% of whom have been convicted, and the growing crackdown on the rights of those prisoners held inside Israel in violation of international law, the group says they've documented.
Since 1967, more than 700,000 Palestinians have been arrested by the Israeli authorities. That number represents about 20% of the total population, of the total Palestinian population. And when you consider that most of the people who are being arrested are men, it actually represents about 40% of the male Palestinian population. And there are kind of five broad categories of offenses. The first one is named by Israel hostile terrorist activities. So that's anything to do with military activities, but it means any activity that's carried out in the context of membership of what Israel calls an illegal organization. So if you, for example, write a political slogan on the wall, or you serve coffee to somebody who is associated with an organization that's considered illegal by Israel, you can be arrested under this category of hostile terrorist activities. And you have to remember that all the political parties in Palestine are considered illegal. So Israel's official peace partners are also considered illegal. So it's really a means to arrest pretty much anyone you want, and you can use the law to arrest whoever you want to. The second category of offenses is something that's called disruptions of a public order, and that covers a wide range of civic activities. So any activities, civic activities like organizing a demonstration or taking part in a demonstration of more than 10 people, writing slogans on the wall, distributing the Palestinian flag, all of these activities are considered illegal by Israel, and they can be penalized with up to 10 years in prison. And all of these offenses are categorized as disruptions of a public order. So you have these hostile terrorist activities and the disruptions of a public order, and those are the two categories that Adamir works on. Then you have three other categories that relate to criminal prisoners, and there it's Palestinians being arrested in areas B and C of the West Bank for either classic criminal offenses like theft or murder or anything like that, or traffic violations. You can actually be arrested by Israel for violating traffic laws in the occupied West Bank. And then finally, you have illegal entry into Israel. So that's usually Palestinians entering Israel to try to find work. And the majority of the criminal prisoners are actually Palestinians who are just trying to find work in Israel and cross into Israel illegally. Now, these Palestinians who were arrested for these offenses are held in approximately 17 prisons, all of which, except for one, are located inside Israel and not in the occupied Palestinian territory. According to international humanitarian law, a protected person who's arrested by the occupying power should be held inside the occupied territory, not outside of it. And transferring the population is illegal. So the very establishment of these prisons inside of Israel is illegal. But in addition to that, it also means that visits by families and by lawyers are very difficult because families have to obtain permission to enter Israel from the Israeli authorities. Very often they're denied. Only immediate family members are allowed to go and visit, so parents, brothers, sisters, children. Nobody else from an extended family is allowed to visit. If you're a Palestinian lawyer from the West Bank, you are in fact not allowed to visit your client inside a prison in Israel. So these lawyers will only be allowed to see their clients during the trials which take place in military tribunals that are located in the OPT. So it has, not only is it illegal, but it has consequences on not only family visits, but also the right to an effective defense. There has been a kind of steady worsening of the detention conditions in that sense in the past few years. In the early phases of the occupation, detention was seen as a time as well where you could be educated, you could become more politically involved because the prison life was much more organized. In recent years, more and more prisoners are being denied education. And in fact, just when the deal was announced, there was a hunger strike by a large number of prisoners who were protesting a number of measures that had been taken after a speech by Prime Minister Netanyahu on the 23rd of June. And those measures related to education, they related to family visits. And essentially what Netanyahu said is that because Gilad Shalit was still being incarcerated, Palestinian prisoners should be punished. They should not have these generous, he called them overly generous, detention conditions. And until the release of Gilad Shalit, all their privileges should be withdrawn. So what happened after that speech is that all access to education was banned. Prisoners were cuffed to and from family visits. In some cases, family visits were reduced from 45 minutes to 30 minutes. They had no access to newspapers, to books, and other educational materials. They had limited access to TV, and a number of other measures were taken by the Israeli prison service. So the prisoners went on a hunger strike on the 27th of September to protest all these measures. And then, obviously, the prisoner exchange deal was announced in the middle of a hunger strike, in their third week of hunger strike. But up until now, we still don't know if those conditions will be reversed. So although they were all linked specifically to the detention of Gilad Shalit, and Gilad Shalit is now free, there still hasn't been an official announcement by the Israeli prison service that those measures would be withdrawn.
That was Clea Towan, the international advocacy officer with a prisoners' rights group, Adamir. Find more information on the work of Adamir on our website at btlonline.org.
Thanks to Between the Lines for that interview. Now on Making Waves, we bring you a song by David Rovics entitled Occupation.
Ask me how it is that I dare to take a side. You say I loathe myself, pointing out you have lied. You say it's tribal warfare, but I disagree, for the dynamics of the situation are not difficult to see. On the one side is the fighter jet, on the other is the stone. On the one side is the slave, on the other is the throne. For the many there are checkpoints, while foreign soldiers rule the streets. For the one side there is victory, but the people don't accept defeat. The word you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the tanks return to Tel Aviv. On the one side there is hunger and bulldozed olive trees. On the other is the army, ruling by decrees. Caterpillars maul the streets, destroy whole city blocks, while children swallow shrapnel for the crime of throwing rocks. Fences are erected around the towns they flatten, and Herzl's own fanatics sleep on sheets of satin. And they water their plantations, drilling ever deeper wells, while the displaced children of the hopeless are filled with bullet shells. The word you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the settlers return to Tel Aviv. On the one side there's the Mossad, rounding up the men, thrown in jail with no trial, being tortured once again. On the other there is rage, helplessness and fear, and a growing realization that another Holocaust is near. On the outside there are prisons, the inside detainees being stripped of their humanity, beaten naked to their knees. Outside the ghetto walls, stormtroopers all around, while inside the hungry people yearn for liberated ground. The word you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the jail guards return to Tel Aviv. Children of Jerusalem will be free one day. In overcrowded camps amidst the stench of death and flies to the suburbs of Detroit, you can hear the anguish cries. While in the land of Israel, with God ever on their side, walls and fences are constructed, papers are denied. People fight for their existence while we turn a blinded eye, and those who should know better insist on asking why. The words you need to know is occupation, very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It will come on the day the refugees return to Tel Aviv.
That was David Rovics singing Occupation. You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. And now for another song, this one by Zarsenga, entitled Row Row Kada. Thank you. was Roro Keda by Zarsenga. You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Next, we go to a WBAI Sunday News report asking, where are the jobs? Earlier this month, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that the U.S. unemployment rate remained at 9% in October. However, the U.S. Senate declined twice to take on President Obama's jobs bill. On Sunday, November 6, the New Jersey League of Women Voters moderated a panel of experts featuring Nobel Prize winner and political commentator Paul Krugman, community activist Larry Hamm, and labor organizer Carol Gay to discuss and offer insights into the situation. WBAI reporter Fred Nguyen was there and filed this segment.
You go to fast food restaurants, McDonald's and Burger King, people stand by the menu boards begging for food.
The job situation is creating desperation in New Jersey's poor neighborhoods. Larry Hamm's People's Organization for Progress has been leading daily vigils in Newark for 140 straight days and is calling for a march against corporate greed in that city on December 6.
Newark has one of the highest foreclosure rates in the state. They have a 40% foreclosure rate in Irvington. And we're throwing people out of their homes because they can't pay their property taxes. But Prudential has built a sports arena in Newark and owes $200 million in taxes. If we have to pay our taxes, they should pay their taxes too.
Carol Gay, president of the New Jersey Industrial Union Council, simply set the problem as one of fairness.
My question is, why do the banks and corporations get to take in the profits, pay huge salaries and bonuses, even after being bailed out in some cases, while workers are losing their jobs, houses, and health care, or while students rack up lifelong debt for their education? If there's one thing that's crystal clear at this stage of the crisis, it is that more cuts will not help us. Tax cuts and incentives for the wealthy and corporations have repeatedly failed to put Americans back to work.
For Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman, fixing the economy is not that hard.
A lot of what's dragging down the economy is the burden of consumer debt, and we should certainly have a major program of mortgage principal reductions, of debt forgiveness. And in the meantime, while we're working that out, the answer is for the government to spend. How could there be a better time to be doing public works projects? We have millions of unemployed construction workers. The federal government can borrow long-term at an interest rate of 2%.
But this simple logic is still falling on deaf ears because, says Dr. Krugman, the focus in Congress has been on deficit reduction. Popular discontent, however, is beginning to influence the agenda.
This is where the Occupy Wall Street has been so amazing. I think the state of our discussion was so surreal. The emperor had no clothes, and yet nobody was saying it. And then a fairly ragtag group of ordinary people start camping out in a few parks in major cities, and all of a sudden, it's like the country woke up. What on earth have we been talking about these past 2 years? Why aren't we talking about the jobs crisis? Why aren't we talking about why some people are doing so well and whether perhaps we should do something about inequality instead of enlarging the holes in the social safety net?
Despite laying off 300,000 state and local government employees to reduce budget deficits, the economic crisis has not been solved, and voters in this past week's election rejected limitations on collective bargaining. It is time, said Carol Gay, to do what is right.
You cannot get us out of this job crisis without revenue. And they didn't want to stop the wars, and they didn't want to raise taxes. And those were the two obvious places where to save money. So it's got to be really bold, and it's going to take a lot of money, which means you've got to raise taxes on the super wealthy. I mean, they're the ones that got all the money over the last 10 years. So let's take it back.
For the WBI Sunday News, this is Fred Nguyen.
You're listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. We next bring you another Between the Lines interview. This one about the police raid that recently happened on Occupy Wall Street in New York.
Just 2 days short of their two-month anniversary, New York City police swept into Lower Manhattan Zuccotti Park, the original site of the Occupy Wall Street protest movement, and evicted activists, arrested 200 people committing nonviolent civil disobedience, and carted their tents and property away. A member of the city council and journalists were arrested during the raid. New York City's Mayor Michael Bloomberg justified the eviction, saying that health and safety conditions had become intolerable in the park, a statement disputed by Occupy activists. Bloomberg told protesters they could return to the park, but without tents or tarps, an order upheld by a New York State Supreme Court judge. The unannounced New York City police raid in the early morning hours of November 15th came as similar suppression tactics were used against Occupy protest encampments in other cities across the U.S. Evictions carried out by police had earlier targeted protesters on the campus of the University of California at Berkeley and in Oakland, California. With the initial rapid expansion of the Occupy movement, established to protest corporate greed, growing income inequality, and political corruption, followed now by government action to suppress the encampments, activists are now confronted with important decisions on how best to disseminate their message, gain wider public support, and affect policy. Your reporter spoke with journalist Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper and a co-founder of the Occupied Wall Street Journal, published by activists in Zuccotti Park. Here, Gupta discusses New York City's decision to dismantle the original Occupy Wall Street encampment and the tactical and strategic choices that must now be made by the Occupy movement.
It's violent, it's excessive, it's hypocritical, and it's to be expected. This is the revenge of the 1%. They have been trying to attack this movement since the beginning. In New York City, there was a series of mass arrests and attacks on September 24th and October 1st. About a month ago, we saw that whole spectacle of Bloomberg claiming everyone had to leave so they could clean the park. And then he ended up backing down when there was an enormous outcry. We've seen in many other cities attacks saying that, oh, there's violence, in cities like Oakland, an extremely violent city. We see hypocritical appeals to the First Amendment, that somehow people in public spaces exercising their democratic speech, having more democracy, is denying others any democracy when there was virtually none to begin with. So they want to shut it down, the 1%, because it is basically made the extreme concentration of power and wealth the number one political issue. And that means if this continues to be an issue, they will have to give up some of their power and wealth, or it will be taken from them.
Arun, do you see this police action in New York City and the other similar suppression tactics around the country as being a handicap to this movement or actually energizing it? Because we've seen outpouring of support after police action similar to this in the past in Oakland, as well as New York City and many other places around the country.
Well, it depends. You know, it's based on how each individual movement responds to it. So far in New York, it was those two police attacks on September 24th, which produced that infamous viral video of police pepper spraying women who were just standing on a sidewalk. And then a week later, over 700 people were arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge. Those two incidents really built the movement. It brought it to national and international attention. Of course, what happened in Oakland also with the very violent police response, that sparked the general strike in that city. But in a lot of smaller cities that I've visited or been to, you know, it has not shut down the movement, but it's created difficulties. Every successful social movement is going to be repressed because what they're doing is exposing the corruption of the dominant order. So the dominant order is going to counterattack. So the question is, how do they respond by trying to circumvent and overcome this repression?
Arun, how important is occupying public space to the growth of this movement? Is it symbolic only, or is it of critical importance to keep the movement growing and expanding its reach?
Occupying space is what created this movement. There wasn't this movement before the occupations began. What there was were a lot of great people doing important work out there, a lot of organizations. There was massive discontent and despair, and what the Occupy movement shaped it, it turned that despair into hope, and it created this movement of the 99%. There was no discussion beforehand of the 99%. So having these physical occupations allowed people to come there and engage in real democratic decision-making, participatory democracy. And so many people who I've talked to at all these occupations I've visited said for the first time in their life, they felt their voice mattered. It was like an epiphany to find so many other people who were dealing with the same issues they were dealing with, lack of health care, not enough employment, about to lose their home, you know, onerous student debt. And they felt isolated. And what this did was really bring all these people together in a way that created the community that made them feel that they were creating the new society. Now, that's what it did up to this point. Going forward, I think these public spaces are important because we don't have any sort of democratic, public democratic forum in this country. That's why it became a social virus that spread and mutated so rapidly. But the movement needs to think about how it's going to respond, and part of that can be different types of occupations. We're seeing an Occupy the Universities and Campus movement. Occupations of workplaces are important. Occupations where goods are being shipped or transported are important. On Thursday, November 17th, there's a planned occupation of Wall Street in terms of protesters are going to try to peacefully, nonviolently shut down the New York Stock Exchange itself through mass of numbers. And so that's a different form of occupation. So, yes, the public spaces are important, but the public spaces are not everything.
That was journalist Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper. For more news, analysis, and commentary on the Occupy Wall Street movement, visit our Between the Lines special Occupy Wall Street coverage and resource page at btlonline.org.
Next on Making Waves, we shift our focus to an upcoming cultural holiday here in the United States. That would be Thanksgiving. We start with a hidden history segment talking about some harsh realities about Thanksgiving Day's history.
Hi, I'm Jack R. Johnson, and this is Hidden Histories. Thanksgiving Day, a time of fat if frightened turkeys, cranberry sauce, and pumpkin pie, is conventionally marked by an amiable feast that was supposedly held between the Puritans of New England and the surrounding Indian tribes. The only problem is there is scarcely any historical evidence to recommend this view. The Puritans were hardly friendly towards the Indians. They viewed them as dangerous and illiterate heathens at best, and spawns of Satan at worst. The odds of them actually sitting together for a day of mutual thanks, even as a harvest-type festival, is doubtful. According to William B. Newell, former chairman of the Anthropology Department at the University of Connecticut, the first official Thanksgiving Day celebrated the massacre of some 700 Pequot Indian men, women, and children during one of their religious ceremonies. Unfortunately, the idea that the Puritans would actually give thanks for a massacre of the Indians is hardly surprising. In fact, there's much historical evidence to back up this view. Here is William Bradford in his famous history of the Plymouth Plantation celebrating the famous Pequot Massacre. Quote, "Those that scraped the fire were slain with the sword, some hewed to pieces, others run through with their rapiers, so as they were quickly dispatched, and very few escaped. It was conceived they thus destroyed about 400 at this time. It was a fearful sight to see them, thus frying in the fire, and the streams of blood quenching the same, and horrible was the stink and scent thereof. But the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, and they gave the prayers thereof to God, who had wrought so wonderfully for them, thus to enclose their enemies in their hands, and give them so speedy a victory over so proud and insulting an enemy." Unquote. This is Jack R. Johnson for Hidden Histories, wishing you a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. just make it go back. Beating hearts, come as one, come as one. This is Indian country. This is Indian country. Together we dance. There's no chance we ever gonna give up. Beating hearts, come as one, come as one. This is Indian country. This is Indian.
We just heard Hidden Histories with a Thanksgiving Day reality check, followed by Robbie Robertson singing Stomp Dance, reminding us that this is Indian Country. Next on Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire, we turn to Outside the Box, brought to us by social justice activist Larry Danziger, with resources for organizing and social change, and WERU in Blue Hill, Maine. He also talks about Thanksgiving, but about a different sort of grace that might be said at the table.
Hello. Here's an outside the box that you may not thank me for. Today's topic is Uncle Larry's Grace. Soon, most of us in this country will celebrate Thanksgiving, usually with traditional foods like turkey, stuffing, pumpkin pie, and cranberries. But when I think of the holiday, I think of the Lou and Peter Berryman song, Uncle Dave's Grace. Uncle Dave is asked to say grace before the Thanksgiving meal. He points out, while saying grace, that much of what we give thanks for has come at the expense of someone or something else. Like the turkey that gives its life so humans can have their holiday feast. But I'm not Uncle Dave. I'm Uncle Larry. So here's my version of the classic song, but with the words only. Hooray! It's a day to eat lots and give thanks. But we can't thank corporations or even the banks. They've taken it all, left us with the dregs. Some folks have nothing. I know one who begs. Recalling who grew it and baked it and such, by exploited workers whose pay is not much, who live in hovels and without benefits. Being so poor means to live by your wits. The turkey is cooked, the plate has white meat, but many are hungry. It's not just, let's eat. We get some food cheap by free trade agreements. While workers lose jobs, it's about dollars and cents. Then finishing up with a pumpkin pie, but farm workers who harvest it might even die. People who eat food with poisons sprayed on can get tumors and cancers, and soon they're gone. The food's put away and the dishes are clean, but there's lots in the trash and it's easily seen. Dumps are overflowing. We've got no more space, 'cause there's only one planet. There's no other place. Then, stuffed to the gills, watching football on TV, where they glorify junk for the world to see. It eats up our resources like there's nothing to lose. Soon, there won't be anything for anyone to use. It's a tense, exciting game, and the locals win out. But the players all lose, beat up and tossed about. Concussions, knee sprains, even some broken bones, with PTSD and permanent groans. And so we give thanks for our yearly pig out. Our girth is expanding, our appearance more stout. Good for grocers and the economy, but unhealthy for you, friends, and family. Am I ready for the poetry circuit? Ha, probably not, but this is what I think of on Thanksgiving. What are you thankful for during Thanksgiving? How do you observe this day? I'm Larry Danziger, thankful for community radio that has run this piece.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome and need your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our ending music is Avalon by Amethystium. You can live stream our show if you are not in range of the station by going to www.portsmouthcommunityradio.org. Remember that WSCA is your community radio station and needs your support to remain on the air. Go to www.portsmouthcommunityradio.org to join and learn more. Ongoing technical improvements for Making Waves also need your help. Go to our website to find out how, www.nhmakingwaves.org. Tune in next Saturday for our next Making Waves program. We leave you today with this quote by Martin Luther King Jr. Human progress is neither automatic nor inevitable. Every step toward the goal of justice requires sacrifice, suffering, and struggle. The tireless exertions and passionate concern of dedicated individuals.